I love telling this story. It's a true story. I tell it a lot, but we sat down with the head of Woodwell at the time. It's a guy named Phil Duffy. And we said, we really want to understand heat, drought, wildfire, hurricanes, floods, excess of water, sea level rise, and basis points. Phil said, it's great to be working with Wellington. We're excited about the partnership. I just have one question for you. What's a basis point? And to me, I love the story because it's so emblematic of the problem. You have climate scientists, very analytical, very rigorous people. You have investors. We think we're analytical and rigorous too. We speak basis points. They speak RCP scenarios, right? No matter what we do today on mitigation, we can stop all emissions today or even yesterday or even a week ago. But the RCP scenarios out to 2040, 2050 are the same. So the consequences of physical climate risk are the same no matter what we do on mitigation in the short term. And so we need to figure out a way to survive and thrive in a changed environment. And that's because of the long half-life of greenhouse gases in the environment.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa. I'm the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI. And today we're going to talk about adaptation. And I'm delighted to have Wendy Cromwell here today with me. She's the Vice Chair and Head of Sustainable Investment at Wellington. Wendy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, look, I'm excited. I saw you are speaking on adaptation at PRI in person in Brazil. We thought we would love to hear your stories and insight. Look, climate adaptation to me is really interesting. The mitigation is still being very slow. The sort of problems in terms of climate impacts are constantly now in the news. I think there's not almost a single day that you go through it. And also, even if all of a sudden we got the mitigation right tomorrow, not necessarily that likely, we would still face a number of the impacts of climate change for at least the next few decades. And these sort of things impact personal lives. You know, we probably have friends that have been impacted. It impacts businesses. And especially, you know, for this show, it impacts investors. How do you look at it? You know, there's new products, there's solutions that can tackle these impacts. Think about things like dams, think about air conditioning, you know, and there's also businesses responding to this, you know, and how do they actually manage that risk. But the reality is for now, often, I think adaptation is seen a little bit as a government responsibility. There's not been much an investment activity on this, at least until recently. And when the investors do come in, it's often in the private markets. And I understand that you guys are instead looking at this, which is really exciting. And so that's the topic we want to cover today. But before we jump in, I'd love to get a sense of, you know, how did you get into this space altogether? You know, you're the head of sustainable investment. Specifically, how did adaptation fall into your remit?
Well, thanks for the question. And thanks for having me. Lorenzo, you and I go back a little bit of time. When I met you, I was already in this role. But I've been in the investment management industry for almost 30 years, and I have had a number of different roles. Immediately prior to the head of sustainable investment, I was leading our multi-asset investment team and group. And so that is a team that focuses across asset classes. It focuses on macro themes. Before that, I was an investor within that team. And in 2018, our CEO at the time, Brendan Swords, we're just a little bit of background on Wellington. We are a very bottom-up, research-led organization. And so we don't do a lot top-down. And so our CEO observed that in this bottom-up, research-led way, people were very interested in ESG and sustainability, and all of the investment teams were looking at it, and we had working groups, but we didn't have a holistic strategy. And he had, I think, the prescience to realize that it was going to evolve from a focus on mainly equities and corporates to a focus on all asset classes. And that having an investment-led approach by a former investor and someone who understood, you know, across the asset class spectrum would be beneficial to us at Wellington because we'd be better able to translate it into investment ideas and themes using the language of the individual asset classes. You know, how is this going to work in currencies? How is it going to work in sovereigns, et cetera? So he asked me if I wanted to lead this area. And at the time I said, Brendan, I would love to, but I don't even know what I don't know. We had launched just a little bit of background why he, besides the multi-asset class orientation and the investment orientation, in my former team, we had launched our first global equity impact portfolio, public securities impact portfolio, non-concessionary, back in 2015. And so we'd done 2 years of research prior to doing that. So he knew I knew a little bit, but I knew I didn't know a lot. And so I asked him for 6 months to study. He thought I was joking, but I was serious. He gave it to me, which was a tremendous luxury. And so I spent all of that time meeting with academics, meeting with scientists, meeting with practitioners across the public market space, the private market space, going to every conference there ever was. I promise you, I feel like I tested them all. And then developed our strategy and relaunched our holistic strategy about 4 months into it. And part of that strategy was identifying where, you know, what our approach was going to be for sure, where we were going to resource things, where we were going to spend, how we were going to expand, were we going to be focused on a product suite, were we going to be focused on embedding it across our investment platform, all of that, what our technology should be, what our data should be, but also where could we lead? So where did we want to be excellent, but then where did we want to provide some leadership to the marketplace? And at the time, the two places that I thought we could provide some leadership, one was public securities impact investing, because we'd already done some of that. And then the other was climate. And that really came from a former colleague of mine who'd done a lot of research into physical climate risk and had worked with an organization, Woodwell Climate Research Center. And at the time, if you think back to 2018, most investors thought that physical climate risk was too far away to matter, that it wouldn't occur within an investable timeframe. And I think we simply just wanted to know if that was true. And so that's how we got to this focus on physical climate risk and adaptation. I'm happy to talk more about that partnership later.
Yeah, look, that's interesting. And it's interesting that you're bringing this multiple asset class perspective to this. And I think when you look at adaptation today, it's interesting how it's often seen more as either the public sector, governments, or it's seen often as private markets, you know. And maybe I'll pick off from there. First question is, why do you think investors across asset classes for now do even actually look at adaptation? I mean, you said in 2018, you know, was it even an issue? Is it today? And should investors jump on it?
Part of that calculus back in 2018 was realizing that there was a lot of focus on transition risk and mitigation. And there were a lot of decarbonization pathways, and there was a lot of carbon footprinting going on in portfolios, and people really were gaining a greater understanding of what that investment would look like, although still more work to do. And really no one was focused on the physical climate risk side of things. So it was, okay, that's happening. Let's focus on this where there isn't as much focus. We formed a climate science partnership with Woodwell Climate Research Center. And originally we looked at a bunch of different vendors, and we evaluated them, and we really thought about our own process. And remember, I told you we're very research led. And ultimately we came to the conclusion that our investors weren't going to accept assumptions made by others that they weren't a part of. They would want to be part of that research dialogue. And so we formed a partnership instead with Woodwell. And I love telling this story. It's a true story. I tell it a lot, but we sat down with the head of Woodwell at the time. It's a guy named Phil Duffy. And we said, Phil, we're really excited to be working with you. We really want to understand heat, drought, wildfire, hurricanes, floods, access to water, sea level rise, and basis points. Phil said, it's great to be working with Wellington. We're excited about the partnership. I just have one question for you. What's a basis point? And to me, I love the story because it's so emblematic of the problem. You have climate scientists, very analytical, very rigorous people. You have investors. We think we're analytical and rigorous too. We speak basis points. They speak RCP scenarios, right? That, you know, those two languages weren't connecting. And so that's how we formed this partnership. And one of the first things we learned from them, and you alluded to this in your opening, no matter what we do today on mitigation, we can stop all emissions today or even yesterday or even a week ago. But the RCP scenarios out to 2040, 2050 are the same. So the consequences of physical climate risk are the same no matter what we do on mitigation in the short term. And so we need to figure out a way to survive and thrive in a changed environment. And that's because of the long half-life of greenhouse gases in the environment. So once we had that insight, we realized we really needed to focus on what was going to happen and how it affect our investments.
Obviously, this is what you've done, and you clearly have continued to doing all these years. Do you feel that this is a lone kind of practice, that you're a little bit like, alone into the desert, or that other investors are coming along? And if so, why? You know, what is driving this adaptation as an important element of your climate finance activities?
I think that climate adaptation right now is very much in vogue. I just came from New York Climate Week. It was every panel, every discussion. People were talking about climate adaptation. People were talking about resilience. Now, there is one issue, and I think you've highlighted this as well, where because asset owners in their frameworks have thought more about commitments to net zero or decarbonization pathways, they haven't actually figured out from an investment policy standpoint how to incorporate climate adaptation into their investment policy, with an exception of in private markets. I think that they've found a way to include it in some of their private market investments. But if you have a goal of decarbonizing your portfolio over a certain time frame, working in climate adaptation doesn't necessarily work neatly into that goal, because some of the investments you will be making aren't necessarily working on decarbonization. They may be more efficient solutions than others available within their sector, but they may be creating emissions on their own. So you mentioned HVAC companies. We're going to have a lot more extreme heat. I think as a society, we're going to choose to allow and help individuals and citizens survive in that changed environment, despite the fact that HVAC creates more emissions in the atmosphere. Now, we'll want to push those solutions to become more efficient. And then we'll also want to find other ways to reduce emissions and find those offsets elsewhere. But so it's that tension between decarbonization and adaptation, I think, that people find difficult.
I mean, I think a few years ago, people would say adaptation is taking away from mitigation. Would you agree with that?
I think there was reticence that if we allow adaptation into the dialogue, that means that we're giving up on transition and mitigation. I don't think that's true. I mean, you know, just based on this learning that no matter what we do, we're going to experience some level of increased physical climate risk. I think we have to do both. I don't think it means we're giving up. I think that it means that we actually have to recognize the science, and we need to do both.
And in terms of doing this across asset class, going back to your expertise, you know, you've heard in New York that it's been a lot more aligned to certain aspects that are about the private markets. You're doing it in the public markets as well. How are you doing it, and how is it different?
There's two ways, and I'm going to start with our original intention. And our original intention was, again, to see if it matters, to see if climate risk matters within an investable timeframe. So we worked with Woodwell to understand those seven perils that we mentioned: heat, drought, wildfire, hurricanes, floods, access to water, sea level rise, where, over what time frame, and then how it might impact the securities that we invest in. So they brought climate science to help us build granular grid maps. We then overlaid those grid maps with capital markets information, and all of that became an in-house desktop tool that we refer to as CERA, C-E-R-A, Climate Exposure Risk Application. And it allows investors to look at their holdings or their potential holdings through this lens. And it is more natural to look at it for places where, for securities where location forms some of the value of the security. So the biggest users are some of our investors in mortgage-backed securities or securitized or municipal loans. So if you think of a municipal bond is actually financing a project in a specific location over a relatively long time horizon. So if you're going to buy a municipal bond, you want to know if that location is going to be implicated by some sort of climate risk. And if it is it priced? And what that team finds regularly when they're looking through this tool is that they can find two different issuers in different locations with the exact same capital markets characteristics, yield, maturity, et cetera, and very different climate outcomes. So on a day-to-day basis, they're picking the one that has the same price and the lesser climate risk. So that helps in a select, it helps obviously from a risk mitigation standpoint and then in a selection criteria standpoint. It doesn't apply evenly across asset classes. As I mentioned, it has the securities that are most impacted are the ones that rely on location for some part of their value. So that is our original intention is, will this company be impacted by flood? Will this project be impacted by some peril? And then in doing that work over time, we became more and more exposed to and convinced of the idea that there are some companies that will provide solutions to these problems that will help individuals and society survive, maybe thrive in a changed environment. And that if we were to invest in those, it would allow them to grow their business, that they would be good growth opportunities because we're going to have more physical climate risks and more events. So they'd be good stocks, if you will. And then they also be helpful at solving this problem. And so that's how we launched into the public securities space in terms of adaptation.
That's interesting. So you kind of started more from a risk management side and moved into that solution element as well.
Because of my background and Chris Gulgasian, who is our director of climate research, because of his background, we both worked in the multi-asset field prior to moving over. We both went into this partnership really thinking that we were going to do a lot of top-down analysis, GDP analysis, how is this going to affect, you know, various regions and countries? And what we quickly came to understand is that these are very localized impacts and that you have to be much more granular and that the insight is going to come from that granular analysis versus a top-down analysis. Now, eventually, we worked ourselves to rolling up a lot of the granular analysis so that we could have climate-adjusted capital market expectations and things like that. But we didn't start there. We tried to start there and we recognized that that was folly. And so then we started from the bottom up and built to that.
And your framework, these seven perils, which you're pretty good at memorizing, these are risks. And I mean, some of the people that I've spoken about adaptation take it often from a sector perspective. Was there a reason why you chose a risk angle versus a sector perspective, or how do you play with the sectors, if at all?
In working with Woodwell, this is the first year of our research with them. The way that it worked is that we would study a peril for 2 months. And so the beginning of that would be, we want to understand heat. And they would say, well, what types of things do you want to understand about heat? We would tell them some of the questions that we had. They would help us select a metric that was most relevant for that. We would agree on that metric. They would give us a whole bunch of reading, sort of curated reading so that we could get smarter. They would come to us with research on using that metric about how it was going to change over different timeframes, geography by geography. That we would have a meeting, investors and scientists, and that would prompt, oh my goodness, look at this. Drought, for example, is one of my favorite examples. When we saw the drought maps, there's, you know, drought happening in a lot of different areas. And one of the areas was the Iberian Peninsula. And so we zoomed in on that and we said, there's a lot of market cap there. We need to understand that better. And then we brought in additional investors to help us understand that. And so I think you need to understand the perils in order to understand the sector implications. And the perils lead you to that. It goes across sectors. And after we went through that first year of research, really understanding those perils, we then started to launch individualized products on agriculture or other sectors or areas or themes, commodities, et cetera. Yesterday we did insurance, but we had to get the perils in order to launch into the deeper research sector by sector. The perils led us to the implications.
Trying to visualize this, what kind of companies or solutions are we talking about? Could you give us an example of a solution side adaptation and a different example more on that risk management side?
So on the solution side in the public securities equity space, the types of names that we find are, we mentioned HVAC companies, we mentioned generator companies, engineering and construction companies, pest companies, water companies, some healthcare companies because of what we know about vector-borne illnesses and how they're going to spread. So it really does span most sectors. And our research, in order for something to qualify to be an adaptation name, we do have a revenue threshold that 50% of the revenues of the company must be derived from trying to solve this problem. Now, I will say to you that the companies don't often see themselves as climate adaptation companies. We help them identify themselves as that. In meeting with a company, sometimes we will provide them with this analysis and help them understand that this is an opportunity for them, and sometimes help them see where they may be able to expand their market by doing that. But you don't find a lot of companies listing themselves as, I'm a climate adaptation company. It's really, they're providing a solution that is needed in the marketplace, and we identify it as one that is associated with helping to solve one of these perils.
And when you kind of bring that up, how do they engage on that? Do they welcome that sort of positioning and therefore maybe even change the way they think their strategic direction as a business?
We have a good dialogue with these companies, and companies and heads of companies are always looking for ways to grow and expand their markets. And so if we identify for them based on our physical climate risk research areas that may also need their solutions where they're not currently providing their solution, that's a win-win for them and for us. So they're very receptive. You also asked me on the risk identification side. And so similarly, I provided earlier the example of municipal bonds. Same thing would happen with securitized. But in terms of equity analysis, I'll give you an example just to bring it to life. We were looking at a particular company that had recently built a $2 billion plant in what we had identified in our work with Woodwell as a floodplain. Now, when you identify this physical risk, it only shows that the company or that location is susceptible to the risk. It doesn't tell you if the company itself has built in any resilience measures to that risk. So you can't make an assessment just based on the physical climate risk potential. You really do need to talk to the companies and say, hey, it looks like you just built a plant in a flood zone. Did you know that? Have you done anything about it? And what happened with this particular company is it became very aware that they hadn't considered it. And so that was, one element of our assessment of that company that, and we did not buy the security. And the reason was, if they haven't thought about this risk, what else haven't they thought about? So it was more about management quality and how in depth they are. And we just lost confidence in them. But that's the type of thing. That's how we would use it alongside our meetings with companies and making those types of investment decisions.
Climate Action 100 Plus seems to, for example, be focusing on the mitigation side. Should Climate Action 100 Plus or others be taking on the adaptation angle?
In order to do climate adaptation work, you actually need to know where companies have significant operations. You need to know those locations. Companies are not required to report their locations and any sort of financial filings. And that was actually work that we did with the SEC when they were exploring the mandatory climate disclosure rule that was pretty apolitical from both sides of the aisle, interest in this idea of asking companies to disclose their physical locations. The way it was written into the rule wasn't exactly perfect in my view. It was written like disclose where you have significant climate risk to a location. We don't think you need that because we think the market can help identify that. All we need is the locations. So right now, what we've done at Wellington is we hire interns. Literally every year we're hiring interns, and those interns are helping us look up company locations. It seems like that's pretty inefficient. Not everyone's going to hire interns to do that. It seems like it just should be market information so that the market can help companies assess this risk and price it. But that isn't the case today. So I would ask you and all your listeners to really advocate for that in various forms.
Look, I think this comes across in climate and nature. All these location-specific risks require understanding where the businesses have their operation. So I'm totally with you.
We've asked for supply chain data for a long period of time, and we've gotten some limited traction. But I would just highlight again to your listeners that now is also a very good time to be supporting supply chain transparency, because there's an additional reason for companies to invest in supply chain transparency and understanding their supply chain, and that is the tariffs. So it's not a climate reason necessarily or a nature reason, but it is an additional factor that maybe focuses their attention on this issue that could be beneficial from a climate analysis perspective as well.
Is there a role for technology and AI in either trying to solve the supply chain or this location issue, or more broadly, how much have you used technology in your attempt to manage adaptation?
I'm not sure you're going to qualify this as AI, but in terms of our idea generation, we do use natural language processing to look at transcripts and investor presentations, quarterly earnings calls. We feed it keywords that we think are associated with these perils and with physical climate risk and with resilience. And that helps us identify potential investments for our investment universe. So that's one application. Again, you have to do a lot more digging post that, but it like feeds up, you know, areas to look. In terms of AI providing solutions, we do see, and on the private side, in addition, so we do have a private investments climate innovation fund as well. We see new investee companies that are helping to facilitate more supply chain transparency. And that does embed AI into that application. We also see on the physical risk side of things, on the private side, companies that are helping cities sort of become more resilient. So, for example, analysis helps them do better analysis to understand floodplain management, the build, rebuild decision, and whether that's wise or not. So we see specific companies devoted to that as well.
As you think of the topic more generally, is there some other call to action you would encourage your colleagues in this field to look at when they're thinking about adaptation?
Well, you asked earlier, you know, why are people talking about this now? And I think they're talking about it now more so because we haven't seen as much momentum around transition. Policies have become more fragmented. And so people think, okay, because of that, we are going to have more frequency and intensity of these perils or extreme weather events. And so therefore, we should focus on adaptation. I think that is true, but that was also true before. I, you know, encourage everyone, like this is a space where we do need to fund solutions and where we do need to do risk analysis, and we need to help companies understand their exposure and prepare for that exposure. So that again, as citizens, as economies, as society, we can survive, potentially thrive in a changed environment, which we will all experience.
Looking forward, COP30 is coming. And then beyond, what would you see happening or evolving in the adaptation space?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but in terms of COP30, the last few COPs, I guess the last two, you've seen the word adaptation more brought to the fore, whereas before it wasn't as much of a focus, even though we had these country-based adaptation plans. So it is more of a focus. I think we should welcome that focus. We shouldn't think of it as like offsetting the focus on mitigation and transition. It's complementary. We need to do both, as I mentioned before. It seems like at this COP, there's potential to rally around a set of metrics that are going to help understand where we are in terms of adaptation. And that seems like it's the probably high probability that's going to be agreed to. And I guess under the guise of what gets measured gets managed, that, you know, that's a start. It's not enough, but it is a start. I think that's probably the number one potential outcome of this COP. I'm not sure what we'll get to beyond that.
Okay, well, look, I think we're starting to head towards the end of the show. I wanted to maybe start with what we do, an art twist at each show, where we ask guests to pick up some sort of art piece that links to sustainability or climate or adaptation that is close to your heart and share what it is and why you like it.
So I actually have two pieces. I hope that's okay. I'm not even sure it qualifies as an art piece. But it was a gift, and it was actually a gift from Chris Gulgajian, who I mentioned earlier, in the holiday period. And it's a piece of canvas, and on it, there's a poem. So you probably bought it on Amazon. So that's why I'm not sure. It doesn't qualify necessarily as high art, but it's one of the most thoughtful gifts that I've ever received. And the poem is the Theodore Roosevelt, A Man in the Arena, Man in the Arena poem. The words have been changed to woman in the arena. And if you haven't seen it, you should definitely look it up. But what that poem really is talking about is people who devote themselves passionately to an endeavor because they think it's important. And sometimes they succeed or have successes, and sometimes they fail or have failures. But the point is that they dare to try, and it celebrates that attempt. And so it's a very thoughtful gift for people who are working in this space, because we have successes, we have failures, but we are daring to try. The second, and that hangs in my office. I mean, that hangs in my home on my bulletin board. And then in my office at Wellington has a remarkable contemporary art collection. And I was fortunate enough to be able to select one of those pieces for my office. And the piece that I selected is by an artist, Casey Roberts. And I'll describe it for you. I can send you a photo as well. It's kind of a moody piece. It's sizable. It's dark in the foreground. It has the trunk of a tree, has three small white butterflies. And carved into the trunk of a tree are initials, including some in hearts. And the title of the piece is History of Love. And to be honest, I chose it because I liked it. I thought it was visually appealing. It was somewhat romantic. It evoked nature. But then when you gave me this assignment, I really thought about it more. And I think on a deeper level, what I like about it is that it links humanity and nature. And it reminds me every day when I walk into my office that some elements of nature will exist. Nature in all of its forms will exist beyond me, beyond you, and yet it will capture our history. And so I can't imagine a better piece to start my day with every morning.
Amazing. We will certainly share it on screen. We kind of wrap up usually an episode with a few quick fire questions. Basically, you know, quick responses, 15, 20 seconds each. And so I'll kick off. First one, adaptation. Alpha or beta?
I'll say alpha for the reasons I described before. I don't think you can do a quick quantitative analysis and figure out what's going to be impacted. I think you do have to do that deeper level of research to understand if resilience has been embedded into the companies or issuers we're evaluating.
Bigger impact on portfolios, heat or water?
I'm going to say heat now. Water later.
More likely to deliver real change, investors or governments?
I think governments have a bigger potential to really change the equation here. It's just whether or not they have the political will to do so. for adaptation because I think they will see the impact on their citizens. They will eventually get there.
Adaptation for the global south will happen? Yes or no? And when?
I think it will happen, and I think it will happen later than we want it to. I think we'll have to experience more significant peril for people to act, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess your painting is going to call us out. Carbon offsets, yes or no?
I think yes. I think we need more rigor around them, but yes.
I think there's going to be a lot of that at COP.
I think that's true.
AI and investing, game changer or gimmick?
Game changer. Just talking to actually our commodities team leader day before yesterday, David Chang, good friend of mine. We sit a few offices down from each other, and we were talking about how we should be thinking, think AI first. Like, before you do anything, can AI do this for me? So I think it is a game changer.
And PI in person, best place to learn or best place to network?
I'm going to say best place to network, but by networking, you learn. I think the value of PRI is that there are 5,300 signatories from around the world. And at PRI in person, you get to really talk to them, experience the content that PRI has created together, and ask questions of each other and of the PRI and the presenters. So I'm going to say the network.
Wendy, this was great. I really appreciate your insights, and I'm sure others are going to want to line up and hear your further insights at the presentation of PRI in person and beyond. It's almost like we've been working with one hand to play the piano on climate, which is mitigation. And now we're all of a sudden we got another one, you know, it's the adaptation hand. And you know, it seems to be that with that, you need a different score. And, you know, that means you need different kind of ways and approaches. You also need to recognize that you need to bring in across asset classes. So the fact that you're looking at the public market and not only private market, I think it's extremely interesting. And to me, it's fun to see that you have a solution approach, which is not where you started, but you still have that risk management piece that still is very much at hand. So, and maybe as a last thing, I thought it was interesting your points in your call to action to encourage that location-based information to be available for investors to be able to do their job better, and that supply chain information to be also brought out to the public to allow for ultimately better investment decisions. So look, let's play the piano with both hands. Thank you again, Wendy. We really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. See you in Brazil.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and comment. And we would love to see you in the next show. And until then, stay wired.